Why don't you try some noodles?
They're worms.
I mean, they're worms.
Tony!
They're only noodles, Michael.
This is Snails and Oysters.
Hello and welcome to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bisexual movie podcast. I'm your guest host, the ghost of bisexual legend, Vincent Price.
And I'm just normal Allie Rogers. I'm the ghost of Allie Rogers.
You don't want to try out your Vincent Price impression?
Oh God, I can't. I'm going to be honest with you. I can't even picture Vincent Price.
You would, as soon as you saw his face, you would go, "Oh, of course, Vincent Price."
Okay, hold on. Let me Google. Hold on.
I'm Nat Roberts, by the way. That was an impression. I don't know if you could tell.
Yes. Here we go. Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me.
How are you doing, Allie, in this, the spookiest month of all, October?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I've been trying out making some chai at home. I got a cookbook about cooking with the seasons. Starting to pull out those sweaters one by one.
I'm so jealous. The one downside of LA is there's no sweater weather ever. Yeah. People say there's sweater weather out here, but they're just weak.
No, I think there is sweater weather, but I'm also, you know, that melancholy's creeping in. The longing, the yearning. Yeah, no, I'm enjoying the change of seasons. I'm jealous because a friend of mine, I think, just won wedding gifts forever. So for her friends who just got married, she got them as a gift, the 12-foot Home Depot Halloween skeleton.
Oh my God, yes.
It's really good.
That's really good.
Yeah.
I hope they put it in like a wedding dress.
No, for now it's just normal, but I think Home Depot should really think about having 12-foot skeletons for all holidays.
Absolutely. Or go Build-A-Bear with it turkey. And have different costumes for them.
Sure.
Like this one's a businessman. This one's a bride. This one is a construction
holiday.
I'm on track to have a very October because I have been invited to not one, but two goth parties.
What?
Yep.
I want to go to a...
On subsequent Saturdays. So
wait, I'm so jealous. I want to go to a goth party. What?
I am so stoked. It is very strange. It was literally like days apart. I was invited by people I know from completely separate social scenes. So there was no synchronicity in their thinking.
Are they both goths though? Like,
no, I mean, not on the streets, but who can say? Who's to say what somebody does in the privacy of their own home?
I do have an interesting headline that popped up.
Yeah.
Listeners may know that I have a bisexual Google alert specifically for this podcast.
We should come up with like a little jingle for your bisexual news alert.
This is like a sad headline, one in three cisgender bisexuals are not out to their coworkers.
Oh, that is sad. Well, then again, I don't want to talk about sex with my coworkers of any kind. Like, as far as I'm concerned, my coworkers should think I'm smooth as a Ken doll.
Okay, with that, let's do the movie.
Yeah, you know who's not as smooth as a Ken doll? Joel Schumacher, director of this week's episode, The Lost Boys.
I'm into it.
The Ken doll?
No, that transition from...
The Lost Boys is a 1987 vampire teen horror comedy amalgam directed by the legendary Joel Schumacher, or rather the infamous Joel Schumacher, depending on who you ask. Based on a screenplay by Janice Fisher, Jeffrey Boehm, and James Jeremias. The story is about two brothers, Sam and Michael, who moved to the fictional town of Santa Carla, California, with their mother, their divorced mother, Lucy, to live with their grandfather, known only as Grandpa.
Early on, as they're moving into town, they pass, I think it's a welcome to Santa Carla sign. And on the back, it says, like, murder capital of the world.
Yeah.
Which kind of sets the stage for what's going to come.
Pretty much.
So as they like explore this new place, Michael ends up kind of through a confrontation falling into this group of punk bad boys.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what they are?
Vampires.
Yeah, they're not just punks. They're not just bad boys. They're not just troublemakers. They're vampires. And they pretty much trick Michael into also becoming a vampire by drinking blood. Would you describe it as a trick? I would.
I would describe it as a seduction.
Oh, right. There we go. We're already getting into it.
Yeah. The vampires are ostensibly led by David Powers, this bleach blonde I don't even know how to describe it. Sex pot, played by a very young Kiefer Sutherland. And their membership also includes Star, a mysterious brunette who Michael is infatuated with when he sees her on the boardwalk.
After he drinks the blood, it's kind of all about Michael figuring out that he's a vampire because he has the classic symptoms, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Disappearing from mirrors, ability to crawl on walls, hunger for blood. Yeah, your WebMD vampire.
The dog doesn't like him, right?
Yes.
The dog is very like sensitive. Nanook,
yes.
Very funny name, dog.
Yes.
We'll talk about that.
And there's also sort of a parallel story about Michael's younger brother, Sam, becoming friends with the local comic book store geeks, Edgar and Alan Frog, who are sort of self-proclaimed vampire hunters because they figured out that this town has like an infestation. So as Michael is figuring out his vampirism, Sam is trying to negotiate it as well and arguing with the Frog Brothers over whether or not he needs to kill his brother.
Yeah, and then this is all complicated by the fact that their mom, I don't think we've mentioned this yet, has got a gig at this video store.
Mm-hmm.
Owned by Max Lawrence. And I think at first, Sam thinks that Max is the vampire, not his brother Michael.
No, he knows Michael's a vampire. He thinks that Max is the head vampire.
Oh, got it. Right. And they put him through these tests at dinner. He passes with flying colors because they sneak garlic into his food. It's
and try to spill holy water on him. Yeah.
This leads to, like, I have to say, one of the an extremely action-packed third act of just vampire slaying with one of the craziest and hilarious, most hilarious death scenes I've ever seen.
So basically, the Frog Brothers come over and help Michael and Sam barricade their house Home Alone style against the vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And then they pick off David and his crew one by one until all of the vampires are dead. But Michael and Star, the half vampire, still haven't turned back. So they realize that someone else is the head vampire.
Yeah. And lo and behold, guess who it is? Twist of twists.
It was Lucy all along. Just kidding. It was Max all along.
That would have been a real twist.
Yeah. Well, and then that twist is compiled by another twist when their grandfather, who until this point has been solely a comedic character, he drives his truck into the house, crushing Max, or rather, he drives his truck into the house with a giant wooden stake tied to the front, impaling Max and killing him, releasing Michael and Star from the curse.
Yeah, it's pretty hilarious.
Yeah. Do you want to say the final line of the movie?
Well, basically, he just goes, the grandpa, like, just very nonchalant about his slaying of this vampire, heads to the fridge. He's thirsty, needs a drink. I think he pulls out a soda.
Yeah.
And says, "One thing about living in Santa Carla, I never could stomach all the damn vampires."
Cut to black. That is the end of the movie. There is no resolution beyond that point. Wild.
Truly wild.
So, the film was released in 1987 and became a box office phenomenon thanks to the sex appeal of these young punk vampires. Due to Joel Schumacher's status as one of the few openly gay filmmakers at the time, there's been a queer interpretation of The Lost Boys since its release.
So just so our listeners know, this isn't one a film we've chosen because it has like an explicit bisexual character or moment, but it's much more like belongs in that lineage of like, you know, you can read queerness into it, especially because I think like all vampire movies have kind of an erotic background to them. You know,
there's, yeah, radiating there's, that energy.
Yeah. There's, you know, bodily fluids. There's like temptation, desires that can't be indulged because you might become a vampire. There's biting. There's hunger that can't be fulfilled, yeah. Blah, 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 desire, longing, blah, 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 queerness.
Well, and vampires just have a certain elegance to them almost in almost every version.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I consider myself pretty well-versed in like queer women vampire movies. I went through a phase one summer of just like every, I think I literally Wikipedia'd like queer women vampire movies and watched a ton. But yeah, it was really cool to watch this movie because I hadn't seen, like, I'm not, I'm just like, you know, don't know that much about like vampire movies with men.
That's funny. And it is true. Like, I feel like it's sort of an old hat to point out. Like, there's even a book by Nina Auerbach called Our Vampires, Ourselves, just about how like vampires.
You're joking.
No, seriously. That's a real book I came across in my research. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just sort of talking about how like different iterations of vampires speak to what, you know, we find alluring and dangerous and are afraid of.
Wait, I'm literally putting that on my Goodreads.
Yeah. I want to read it too, actually. Yeah. but yeah. And so like, this movie is fun because its vampires are very much a reflection of the period and the period's anxieties about teenage delinquency, but also missing children. Like, this is a 1980s movie when there was sort of this, you know, fear that there was an increase in children missing. Milk carton kids became a thing. Missing white girl syndrome became a phenomenon on the news, things like that. And that is very heavily emphasized throughout this movie.
Yeah, I also like, I felt like there was also anxiety about like divorced parents. Like, totally. What are the kids doing? Where are they? No one's watching them. Yes. They're running wild.
It's 8 p.m. Like, on a Saturday. Do you know where your children are? They're in a crashed hotel with a bunch of vampires.
Drinking blood. Literally drinking blood.
And I highly recommend, I read a great article for The Atlantic back in 2017 when this movie turned 30. Brandon Tensley wrote a great piece sort of looking back on it and talked about exactly those fears, like that fear of divorce, that fear of like children, you know, not having guidance from their parents. But he very smartly pointed out that this movie also kind of subverts those fears because like Lucy's a good mom. Like, you know, she's getting divorced. She's trying to have a life of her own, but she does care about her sons. And like, for all their fighting, the brothers do still care about each other. And it's never a question really that they're going to try and save each other. And so that's the thing. It plays into and off of the 1980s fears in really fun ways.
It also just has like a really fun aesthetic.
Totally.
I don't know that I like totally know how to describe it. And I don't know if it's too soon to talk about I think this is my favorite death scene in all.
Oh, go for
of
it.
Film. Okay, so when they kill, I forget which vampire is being killed at this point, but they basically prep a bathtub full of garlic,
oh, yeah.
And what I love.
Sorry, it's so good.
You know, it's so good. Please interrupt away. But what I love first is just like this absolutely manic crushing of garlic cloves.
Yes.
that's how the sequence starts in this way that's kind of like hilarious and sloppy. And it does kind of feel like how a kid would address this. Be like, well, let's just buy an insane amount of garlic and crush it. And then they throw it in the bathtub. And like that shot, like all those shots are a little like, I don't know, not like sloppy, but they're not like premium. Like it looks like
it has like a very raw feel to it.
Very raw, yeah. But then what I think is so amazing is eventually when the vampire gets in there, he, like, they manage to get him fully in the tub, and he dies, starts to die, comes back up for air, basically as
a skeleton.
90% a skeleton. Yeah. And then it gets even more gross, where then it's like all the blood, he's basically melting into just blood yeah. that's getting sucked down the drain, and all the pipes break, and the blood's, like, blasting out. I thought it was so funny and horror.
It's like the Raiders of the Lost Ark meets The Shining, you know,
totally.
The like, face melting scene meets the elevator full of blood. It's I would call it camp, like gonzo camp, you know.
Totally, totally. Yeah, and I really loved it. I thought a lot of it was campy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's sort of a signature of Joel Schumacher's style. And we can get into him a little bit because, like, in the 80s was sort of like the peak of his career, and then he had the doldrums of, you know, the commercial success but critical hatred of the Batman films that he did, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. And then, like, the sort of the rest of his career was just sort of like it never reached the same peaks. But I think especially right before and after he died, like, Schumacher kind of came into a new appreciation where it's like, He was, like, a really bold and visionary director, just in a very specific, idiosyncratic way.
Right, right. I have to be honest, I wasn't familiar with, like, his name, but mm-hmm. I'm looking on his Wikipedia now and seeing that he was behind the 2004
yes.
Phantom of the Opera.
Yes, yes, the infamous 2004 Phantom of the Opera.
Dude,
which
that,
my family
the
had
grip,
on DVD.
Oh, the grip that show had on me as a 14, or sorry, not that movie
yeah.
had on me as a 14-year-old. The grip.
Oh my God, yeah.
Like
Gerard Butler can't sing for shit, but somehow that movie, you just buy into it.
Yeah. For listeners like me, can you just give us, like, the top line of Joel Schumacher? I know you just did, but more, like, stylistically.
I'll go in deeper. He reportedly slept with around 10,000 to 20,000 men in the course of his life. That's the top line.
Okay, hold on. I need to do some math. I need to do some math because he died at 80.
Yes. And according to him, he slept with that many men. And he became sexually active at 11.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he also, it's interesting, I saw a quote about the AIDS epidemic where he felt like he most certainly must have gotten AIDS because he was so, like, you know, prolific, but didn't. He never did. He actually ended up dying of cancer in 2020.
That's 250 people a year. Wait, no. Well, that's, like, actually assuming. Hold up,
yeah.
hold up.
So wait, let's do it. 69
assuming
years
that
of sexual
he's
activity.
Sexually active at 69? You're assuming 69?
Well, he said
so
11.
He
said he started when he was 11.
He said 11?
Yeah.
That is so young. I worry. Okay,
yeah,
so that
I worry
is
too, but
like 298.8 people a year.
Yeah.
So let's round up to 290
yeah.
people a year. Okay.
Hey, that's less than one
he
a day. So he still took weekends off.
Wow. Okay,
insane.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the thing. I have no way of verifying. No one has any way of verifying if that's true. That's just his sort of self-reported number.
We could start a podcast called I Slept with Joel Schumacher.
If you or a loved one slept with Joel Schumacher, you may be entitled to financial compensation.
Wow. Okay, but, like, apart from his sexual history, what's his vibe?
Well, he's very famous for being very flamboyant, honestly. Like, in his personal life, in his filmmaking, like, I think it's very obvious in The Lost Boys, especially, like, I would say The Lost Boys is probably the best version of his particular style, where it's like you can't quite put your finger, sometimes you can't quite put your finger on it, but other times you definitely can, that, like, everybody's just very sexual. Like, I think David Powers' portrayal in the Lost Boys is sort of the holy grail of Joel Schumacher characterizations, where, like, it's just very, like, homoerotic the entire time.
Was this the film he was best known for?
I would say, I mean, I think it depends on your generation, honestly. I think people, maybe Gen X or baby boomers, would remember him for, like, St. Elmo's Fire and The Lost Boys, whereas, like, younger Gen X and millennials would probably remember Batman Forever and Batman and Robin a lot more. So you would get like a much more positive and a much more negative recollection of him.
Depending on your age. So funny.
And if you're, you know, one of the two of us, obviously Phantom of the Opera is the film he's best known for.
That definitely. Yeah. I mean, looking at his filmography, sadly, haven't seen a lot of his films.
Yeah,
at
that's
all.
The thing. He has like a very, just a very, it runs the gamut. That's all there is to say about it. Because he also will have something like A Time to Kill, which is a totally straight drama.
When did you first see this movie?
Recently. It was a few years ago, I think. I think it might have been 2020, around the time he died. I went back and like watched this one because I hadn't seen it. And as soon as I saw it, I knew we had to talk about it eventually.
Yeah.
Because like as we said, it's not explicitly bisexual, but as we'll probably get into in the second half of the show, Michael's choice between vampirism and his family is very much framed as a choice between the lifestyle that David is offering him and the lifestyle that Star is offering him. Mm. And both have like a very sexually charged dynamic.
Yeah.
I think like David famously has been interpreted. There's an apocryphal quote from Kiefer Sutherland even acknowledging that the character has a very sensual connection with David.
Mm.
That David has a very sensual connection with Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of like leather clad bleach blonde look.
Well, and just like the confidence, I feel like David represents, I don't know, kind of that, I don't know, that kind of magnetic person that can maybe push you to do things that you wouldn't normally do or shouldn't do.
Oh, like, yeah. I mean, like he has lines like, how far are you willing to go, Michael? My blood is in your veins, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's, or there's the scene where he's just like repeatedly saying, Michael.
Yes.
Michael. Yes. Michael. Yes. Like it's so sexual.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you think? This was your first time watching it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was really fun. I thought like it had such an immediate style right off the bat. Yeah. And like I said, I just really enjoy vampire movies and I enjoy seeing the different tropes,
totally.
You know, like which vampire tropes, like, is this one where they like die in the sun or do they simply sparkle? Do they simply glisten?
Absolutely. And like what are their powers? What are their weaknesses? You know, in this movie, garlic doesn't work, but holy water does. But if you invite someone in, you know, things like that.
Oh, but the garlic did work in the big bathtub, right? Or was it the combination garlic, holy water?
I thought it was just the holy water because doesn't the vampire has a line like, don't you know garlic doesn't work or something like that?
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed that.
That's the thing. It's interesting because this is also a movie about our perception of vampires because Sam and the Frog Brothers use comic books as their sort of dictionary of vampire behavior, you know? So when they get something wrong, it's almost like, no, it's not that they were wrong. It's that we're all wrong about vampires. Mm. This is how vampires work.
Right. Totally. I feel like David kind of reminded me of Iceman.
I can completely see that. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's just the blonde. Maybe
no,
I'm just being,
no, but he has that sort of like antagonistic flirting thing too.
Exactly. It's antagonistic flirting where they're kind of like challenging one another.
Yeah, like pushing each other. I would say that Michael is definitely more of a bottom than Maverick is.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Let's get into Michael. Let's get into the sort of his portrayal as like the, I would say he's the closest we have to a bi character in this film. I would say he's the reason we're here, really, because, like, you know, he is the one making the choice between David and Star, sort of, so to speak. And I don't know, like, how would you, did you read him as bi?
I did, I see that reading. I can understand someone kind of watching the movie and not having, you know, the incredible background in queer vampire movies that I do and not seeing it. But, I definitely felt like it was portrayed as someone, I felt like he was representing someone who was like bisexual, mm-hmm. and had that desire opened, mm. and was very scared by it.
I definitely this time around read him read into his bisexuality more. His like very physical interactions with David. Like the scene when they're hanging under the bridge and like, you know, it's the last two left. And
yeah,
he's like, let go, give yourself over to this mist, this fog, this mystery.
Well, even just like the physical excitement of that scene.
Oh,
you know.
Totally. Or even at the end, after Michael and his brother and their friends have killed all of David's other vampire like cronies, David still wants Michael. He's still like, we can still you know, be together, basically. So it's interesting. It's like their connection is framed as different from David's connection to the other vampires. Their connection is framed as particular, not just because Michael's the main character, but there's some special attraction to him.
Yeah. And even like the fact that Michael has sex with Star in like initially after like realizing that he could become a vampire, it feels a bit like this effort to like verify, oh, no, I'm straight. Like I'm straight. I'm not one of these queer vampires. Look, I'm fucking a lady. Like,
yeah. Well, and Star is relevant to David's portrayal as well because she's ostensibly his girlfriend.
Yeah. But like, right. So it's a bit of a triangle.
Yeah, it's a bit of a triangle, but also like it feels like David is a lot more interested in Michael than Star. And that could be partly that he's the new and shiny one, but.
Oh, I literally kept forgetting that she was his girlfriend throughout the film.
Right, yeah.
I was like, wait, who is she again? She's here. Like,
yeah. She's a half vampire and her brother is too, but like, why haven't they turned her? Yeah.
Yeah.
Classic sexist gay vampires.
Well, it's just really interesting because I think that idea of turning that is like so prevalent in vampire movies is also kind of like this, I think not really true to queer experience, but I think it's how a lot of straight people can perceive it. So it has been perceived that way in a somewhat negative way. And I don't think a queer person would ever describe themselves as turned, but they might think about the first experience they had as one that was like more of like an awakening, you know, but I think that it's.
Yeah. Like a closet key, to put it more positive.
Oh, I love that. I've never heard that. But I love
Oh, really?
That.
Oh yeah. I use that term all the time.
Oh, I love
Shout
it.
Out to my closet key.
Shout out. But yeah, it's really interesting to me that so much of this film is about the fact that he's in the middle and he's in between the two worlds and has to take action to either become part of one or the other.
Yeah, and it's interesting that destroying David in the end isn't what releases him. Like, he thinks it will, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
And even though there is, like, the resolution immediately afterwards, it's almost a joke. Like, the reveal that Max is the real villain is almost like a joke on the sort of patriarchal solution that people might expect from this movie. Like, again, that Atlantic article talks about how, you know, the teenage rebellion is presented as, you know, the dangerous other for the first, you know, 97% of the movie. And it's just right at that end where it's like, oh, you thought this like cheerful patriarch was going to be the solution. No, he's the real problem. And then they blow him up.
Right. Totally.
So it's an interesting tension there.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, especially just thinking about, oh, you think that these people who are like going out of their way to kind of look countercultural are the threats, and like it's the dude, it's always the dude, the normal dude,
it's the the wannabe father figure. And it's great because his dynamic with Lucy throughout the film is so heavily gendered. Like, he's always using these very feminine words to describe her, like, oh, you have a generous heart, or oh, your boys need discipline, you know, things like that. And it's played as charming at first. And then with the reveal that he wants her to be the mother to his vampire spawn, it becomes very twisted.
Well, you actually explained that a little bit because I thought it was kind of funny. I didn't totally understand his like grand master plan. Just
I think it was that he wanted a mother for his vampire kids, basically.
Yeah.
The like for David and the boys, because they're so rowdy, they need a mother's touch. Mm. And so he was going to turn her sons into vampires so that she would willingly agree to become
a vampire. They would all be like one happy family. Got it.
I believe it's Sam who calls it the blood-sucking Brady Bunch. I think that this movie is willing to exist in ambiguity a lot more so than even contemporary queer films, where, you know, it's willing to walk the line between villainy and heroism in a way that's tense, you know, where you want David, but you don't want David, you know, and you want to be a vampire, but you don't want to be a vampire. Mm-hmm. Like, these are very cool queer vampires who are still dangerous and are still evil, but it revitalizes their appeal for a new generation.
Yeah. I really liked it.
Yeah, I think this movie is so much fun.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other scenes that I want to dig into.
Well, I mean, there's the blood drinking scene.
yeah. That scene. So first of all, they're like in a kind of cave, but it used to be a hotel, right?
It's like a hotel that got knocked over during an earthquake.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I'm going to be honest, it has a Phantom of the Opera cave energy. Just like poorly lit, campy place. Yep. Place of frustrated
sexual. I'm just waiting for Kiefer to start singing about the music of the night.
The music of the night. Well, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. They're both figures that crawl around at night.
And Emmy Rossum looks a lot like, I think it's Jamie Gertz. Yeah, Jamie Gertz plays Star. Mm-hmm. That wild brown hair, those big eyes, those doe eyes.
It's honestly hilarious because Star literally is like, it's blood, don't drink it. And he just drinks it.
Yeah.
And then later, well,
later
he's like, why didn't you stop me? And she's like, I tried to warn you. And I literally was like, dude, I had to pause the movie and be like, she literally said it's blood.
Yeah. I think it's played off of the fact that like immediately before that is probably, I would say the most iconic scene in this movie is actually when David gives Michael Chinese food, but then either turns it into maggots and worms or like makes him hallucinate that it's maggots and worms. Like, it's an illusion. It's hard to say which is which, but and so it is a little forgivable that when she's like, it's blood, he's like, ha ha, sure, it's probably wine or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, still pretty dumb.
What did you think of that scene?
He's drinking out of like a bejeweled bottle. Like, it's high camp. It's very flamboyant. But it's interesting because not every vampire story includes the exchange of blood. You know, some it's just you're bitten and you turn.
Yes.
But the older ones in particular keep the idea. But also like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, What We Do in the Shadows, like modern versions have sort of revitalized this idea that it's not just being bitten by a vampire, but drinking a vampire's blood that will turn you. And I think that is partly due to The Lost Boys. Like, this movie did have a lot of influence on Buffy and especially on What We Do in the Shadows.
Ugh, I need to catch up on What We Do in the Shadows. Yeah, I don't know. Before, like, I feel like all the vampire movies I've watched have been very much like, it's not just about being bitten, but maybe about being bitten in, like, a specific way or for a certain amount of time. You know, it's about an exchange of, dare I say, vampire venom. But the blood is pretty, like, you know, pretty hardcore to drink someone's blood.
Yeah, from a bottle, like straight from the bottle. Straight from the bottle. Chaser.
Is it even like properly aerated, you know?
Yeah, they decant it. But also, like, it sort of heightens the sexual nature of it, I think, because it's not just about, you know, the vampire putting their curse on you. It's about you taking something in and giving something back. Like, it's an exchange.
Yeah, it's an exchange, but it's also about being chosen, too.
Mm-hmm. And consenting in some ways.
Yeah, although it's complicated because I wouldn't say he consented. He kind of got, like, roofied with vampire blood.
No, it really is. Like, it's the line is blurred, to quote the poet of our times, Robin Thicke.
Oh, no.
Just kidding. That man's a monster. David is just a vampire. Robin Thicke is a monster.
So initially, David was offering Michael up, right? Like, Star was going to turn Michael? That was the idea?
Yeah, I think it was she was going to kill him and therefore be turned. Like, in this universe, you have to... You're a half vampire once you drink the blood, and then a full vampire once you kill someone.
Got it.
Sort of a blood in, blood out situation. but yeah, it's unclear when along the way David decides that actually, no, I want this stud around for eternity.
Exactly.
Something interesting about this movie, a lot of vampire films focus on the vampire's human life prior to being turned.
Yes.
You know, I think Twilight is an obvious example. Buffy gets into that tons of times. Even What We Do in the Shadows and Dracula, especially Francis Ford Coppola's version of Dracula, get into where the vampire came from. Whereas in this movie, there is no information about any of the vampires prior to being turned.
Yeah, it's kind of refreshing, honestly.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's not really, like, that's very rarely the reason I'm tuning into a vampire movie, to hear about some human guy who will eventually be a vampire.
It also, like, I don't know, like, I don't think these are the most complicated vampires that I've seen on screen. Like, I feel like a lot of the films, and it's been years since I did my summer of queer women vampire movies, but I remember like a common theme was the angst of, you know, these women vampires not necessarily wanting to be bad guys, but having this need to feed, you know, and I think that happens in a lot. I mean, that's like really common in the Twilight movies. They're ethical vegetarian or, you know,
and it's very common in A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. One of our first bonus episodes over on patreon.com/snailsoysters. Sign up for $5 a month to get access to those. But yeah, the idea, the conflicted nature of the vampire themselves.
Yeah. And I definitely don't get, because I guess the reason I bring that up is I feel like a lot of times the vampire's past is kind of a way to make them less of a monster. Like, here's the time when they were human. Sure. This was their human life when they were just like weaklings like us, mortal weaklings. But
just normies.
Yeah. And you should pity them because they live forever and have this need to feed. But this one,
and
I feel like
they look great in leather pants.
Yeah. And they sparkle in the sun. But I feel like this movie, them not having a past, kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that they're like pretty just clear villains.
Yeah, they're pretty into being vampires.
Yeah, they're not like, oh no, should I feed upon the humans?
Oh no, whatever will I do?
Yeah.
But also, like, it sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where it's like it's willing to be ambiguous in a very particular way, where it's like, yeah, they're still appealing, though. Like, they're still appealing. Even though we're not meant to empathize with them, we are attracted to them. And so, yeah, I feel like almost removing that empathy sort of distills what the movie is trying to evoke from us, which is, like, this fearful desire.
Fearful desire.
But, yeah, let's dive into the vampire hunters for a little bit. Sort of the other team in this movie, which is made up of Corey Haim as Sam Emerson, and Corey Feldman as Edgar Frog, and Jameson Newlander as Alan Frog, who I misremembered as Ralph Macchio for some reason, but it's fully
last
not
name
him.
Last name Frog.
Yeah. So I think the first most obvious thing we have to address is Edgar Frog's voice, where Corey Feldman is just talking like this the entire time, like he sounds like a kid trying to sound like an adult, but it like never breaks.
Yeah. Yeah. So
what did you think of that choice?
I just thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
Like goofy,
it's,
you know,
wild.
It reminds me of like being a kid and just being like, I'm going to wear this exact outfit for 1 week. You know, I'm just deciding who I'm going to be and everyone else has to deal with that until I move on.
Absolutely. It's absolutely like that. And it's interesting because Feldman has a rather notorious story as like a child star who fell into addiction. But in the 1980s, he really did have like a string of incredible performances with like Stand By Me and The Goonies. Like he was a very talented actor, and it's very sad that you know, he was abused as a kid, which
horrible,
you know, sort of put him on a cycle of drug abuse as an adult. But I also think like it comes through in some of his better performances as sort of like these big feelings that are too big for a kid to handle.
Yeah.
You know, more so in like The Goonies and Stand By Me, but still here with Edgar and Alan Frog, like we never see their parents. We have no idea like why these two teenagers are on their own hunting vampires.
Yeah. I found that really fun though. And I thought it was a really interesting example of like the way that kids a lot of the time have more insight into like the threats in their life, where like the parents might see the threat as, oh, like people are going missing and these punks are roaming around, and not that there's actual vampires in the world. But yeah, I thought that was really like fun.
Yeah, they're exactly the sort of people you would expect, where it's like these disaffected teenagers who like adopt a worldview of seeing vampires and happen to be correct. And honestly, a bit the same with the grandpa, where it's like he's this weird, isolated old man on a farm outside of town. Like, of course he's going to notice there are vampires in town.
Yeah. I don't know, like, what the name for that trope is, but I love the trope of, like, just people who you thought were crazy actually just or kooky or eccentric and actually know exactly what's going on, you know?
Totally. Well, it's sort of like it's great. Like watching this a second time, I picked up on a lot of those moments, like when Max first enters the home and asks to be invited in. There's a shot of the grandpa watching him. And at first it plays for comedy where it's like, you know, oh, he's like, oh, it's this guy's here to date his daughter. But then on a second viewing, knowing what I knew, I realized like, oh, that's when he realized Max is a vampire.
Right.
Or
right.
At least that's when he suspected it.
It's crazy because it's like, grandpa, you could have told us earlier.
You could have staked him.
Could have staked him earlier. And I think the grandpa is a really funny, like, deus ex machina at the end.
Totally. I think the ending is perfect because they do not try to make sense of what just happened. They just cut to black. Like the like bad version of this is that it's like, oh, now it's a whole family of vampire hunters, and instead it's like, no, it's just right, like one like final indignity before the credits roll.
But poor Lucy, you know, just watched her boyfriend get staked to death, watched him transform into a vampire. She has to really catch up with everything.
Yeah, seriously. She barely got the vampire memo right before he turned into one.
I loved the special effects, too. I kind of loved that.
They're very nice.
They're fun. I like that.
They're very campy, very over the top, but also, like, very gory and grotesque at times in like a really fun and convincing way.
Yeah.
Apart from the bathtub scene, there's the scene where they first stake Marco, as played by Alex Winter, who went on to star in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh my God.
And he's like the fourth vampire. He's the one who like has no lines and dies first.
Right.
But when they stake him, he's like gushing everywhere. It's not Buffy rules where you just dust somebody. It's like every vampire death is as wet as you can imagine.
Oh, it's so gross.
Yeah. And something I like about the Frog Brothers that I didn't notice the first time is that they're as much a liability as they are an asset. Like in the final sort of half of the movie when everybody's teaming up, they're the ones who are like, we should stake Michael. We should stake Star and her brother just to be safe. Like let's stake them all. Fuck it. Like I don't trust these people. And so even though and that just adds to the ambiguity of the whole thing where it's like these are your vampire hunters. You know, they're clearly not purely benevolent either.
Yeah, you're kind of like more seeing them as adversaries.
Yeah.
You know, like the vampires and the hunters are just straight up adversaries and like they're not really interested in plumbing the ethics of killing Michael or Star. You know, they're just like exterminators. Yeah. They're exterminators, really.
Basically, yeah. Or at least that's how they see themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is a really smart screenwriting trick, honestly, like to have that sort of organic conflict within groups so that it's not just red team versus blue team, but it's, you know, you know, here are the vampires. They seem united. Then there's Michael, who's sort of a vampire, sort of not. There's Sam, who's sort of a vampire hunter, sort of not.
Yeah.
There's the Frog Brothers, who are vampire hunters, but aren't necessarily good. And it gives us a perspective of multiple aspects of every character, because in one scene, Sam is arguing with Michael, but then in the next scene, he's defending Michael.
Yeah, yeah.
The last thing I'll say about the Frog Brothers is that they do feel almost like an artifact in some ways of an earlier version of the film that was in development. Originally, you may have noticed Richard Donner is credited as the executive producer of the film. Originally, he was going to direct it, and it was going to be a lot more like The Goonies. It was going to skew younger. It was going to be a pure comedy. It was going to be silly and fun for the whole family. And it was only when Joel Schumacher stepped in that everyone was aged up. The sexual elements were added. But he retained some of these, like, kid elements where, you know, the vampire hunters are kids. Like, even the professional ones are children. And so it adds to that sort of weird tonal imbalance of, like, here's some zany hijinks, here's some, like, hardcore sex, here's some gory violence.
Yeah, blood bath full of blood from a melted vampire. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I love hearing that, like, fact. I love when, like, films develop that way. You can kind of see it, but that it, I love when it all works, you know, like, and it's hard for me to imagine, like, a Goonies version of this film, just because I do think it's more geared towards, I think, you know, anyone going through puberty or who remembers puberty.
Totally. Yeah, I think the Goonies version would have been a lot more like The Vampires versus the Bronx, the 2021 movie, which is good and fun, but doesn't have the staying power, I would say.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. That's been on my list for a while.
It's good. It's fun. Yeah, I mean, I liked it, but it does sort of lack, I think, it's too consistent to be memorable. You know, part of what makes The Lost Boys so memorable is the weird conflicts of, like, internally.
Yeah. I did want to talk about the music really quick, because I just thought all the music choices were really good.
Such good music.
Yeah. I think, like, the first song, or one of the first songs we hear is People Are Strange, where the
Yeah, the lyrics, by Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah, and the lyrics are just, people are strange when you're a stranger. And I think it's a really good song that describes most of my depression, but also, like, I don't know.
And it's great because in the vampires, like, hotel thing, we see that they've put up a poster of Jim Morrison in their, like, hideout. And so to use a cover of a Doors song is really smart.
That's really cool. I missed that.
I didn't notice it till this time, yeah.
But then there's also this creepy children's choir, like, singing, I shall not lie, I shall not kill, and it's so creepy and good.
I looked it up. That is the theme song for the movie that was written for the movie by Gerald McMahon, also known as G. Tom Mack. Yeah, he wrote that specifically for the movie, and it's perfect tonally, because then, like, the lyrics are so heartfelt and 80s, like, after the children's choir, but, like, yeah, it's the musical version of The Lost Boys. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's.
Do you want to talk about the saxophone man?
feel like I missed that. What?
The saxophone man? You missed the saxophone man?
I might have, because at one point our handyman came in.
Oh, so it's the scene when Michael first sees Star in a crowd down by the boardwalk.
Oh, no, I didn't. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Tim Capello, who was famous for doing exactly what we saw him do in this movie. That is to say, gyrating on stage with a saxophone in ways you didn't know a person could
gyrate. Yeah, that's really funny.
Yeah, he played backup for Tina Turner quite a bit back in the 80s and 90s. But yeah, it's that thing of, like, it is so far past, like, good taste that it becomes incredible, you know?
Yeah, totally. Also, just a quick diversion, but one thing that's so funny about the end is you don't really get a sense that, like, I mean, it's like I could see another version of the film where they end it and then, like, you see a text on screen that says 1 month later, and it's like Michael and Star on a date. They're on a date. They're dating, you know, and you kind of
Getting married.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting to me that, like, they are kind of allies, and obviously they're lovers during the film. Mm.
but mm-hmm. also like you don't get any like clear sense of their future, anyone's future, you know?
Yeah. It keeps it from becoming sort of a pat heteronormative ending.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like maybe they were just hooking up while they were allies defeating defeating this ancient evil.
Yeah. I mean, well, they sort of have sex with each other as a way of having sex with David, honestly.
Classic triangulation.
I feel like that's a really good transition into Fuck, Marry, Kill, because I was going to say, do you want to play it with David, Starr, and Michael?
Sure, yeah.
All right. Yeah, go ahead. I have no idea what I'm going to do.
I am going to kill David just for everyone's sake. It's not for me, you know, but it's just like we can't have all these kids going missing.
Yeah.
I'm going to marry Star because I think she just needs to get out of this toxic masculinity vampire scene, you know? And yeah, I'll hook up with Michael because
he's cute.
He's cute, you know?
Yeah.
But David, you know, it's for the greater good.
Yeah. I think I would fuck David though. I think I would.
I'm glad, like, happy for you. Do not apologize. Ideally, do not apologize.
Ideally, I would fuck then kill him. Just to say I did. But barring that, fuck David. I think you're right. Mary Starr, if only because she's also the only one who like is hep to what's going on the whole time. Like she's the one who tries to stop David from becoming tries to stop Michael from becoming a vampire. But I don't want to kill Michael, but I think I will by default. Just because like he is very sexy, but David is just that much more sexy.
Yeah, fair. David's so confident. He wants to take you on cool adventures, like diving off.
He's
a bridge.
He's got stubble and he can fly. I mean, again, I'm gonna stake him after we have sex, but like I want to stake him before I stake him. You know,
he can show you the cool, like, you know, abandoned, you know, Reddit backslash abandoned places. You know, urban explorer.
I can go for a ride on the back of his bike.
Mm-hmm. Or like in the air with him, yeah.
Yeah, or like go for a ride in another sense. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Snails and Oysters, your bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bi-sexual movie podcast. If you like the show, please like it on your podcatcher, review it, share it, whatever. However your chosen platform lets you interact with our show, please do. And if you really, really like the show, you can head over to patreon.com/snailsoysters to sign up for $5 a month to be a patron. For that $5, you will get monthly bonus episodes where Allie and I talk about our favorite movies and My Film Diary, where I review every movie I see. I tried to do that all in one breath.
We also, of course, want to give a shout out to Abby Austin, who did our really adorable podcast art, and to Billy Libby, who did our theme music. Both of their social handles are in the podcast description.
As is our social media links. And yeah. Of course, Snails and Oysters is at Snails Oysters on Twitter. Give us a shout out if you disagree with one of our Mary Fuck Kill takes. If you think that actually The Lost Boys is a story about, I don't know, post-war economics. You know, whatever your thoughts are, we want to hear from you. Mm-hmm. And we also want to say thank you
for being
a bi ally in our battle against sexy vampires.